And here we are back at Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you the news you don't ordinarily get to hear in the corporate media. And certainly that's going to be the case today, because we're very pleased to bring back Stephen Gowans on our program. It's been a while. Stephen is an Ottawa-based author and activist, and he's written a number of articles recently on practitioners of nonviolent activities abroad. And well, let's just see if we have him with us right now. Stephen, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay. Good. You're coming in fairly clearly. Thanks very much for being with us today. I wanted to just let our listeners know, I mean, you've been following the progress of a number of NGOs, organizations that are interested in what's happening with foreign governments, opposition to foreign governments, and so forth. In particular, you've recently written a series of articles on nonviolent organizations, or as I said, practitioners of nonviolent activities abroad. They're basically groups that may be advocating government change in foreign countries. So there's people involved in these organizations like Peter Ackerman and Gene Sharp and Robert Helvey. And I'm just wondering, for our listeners, can you just tell us a few details about, say, Peter Ackerman? Just some bibliographical things that would help us know where he's coming from.
Peter Ackerman, yes. Peter Ackerman, at the moment, heads a private investment firm and sits on the board of the premier U.S. establishment think tank, which is the Council on Foreign Relations. And other members of the Council on Foreign Relations are corporate lawyers, corporate CEOs, former U.S. Secretaries of State and Defense, and national security advisors and various war criminals. He was, until recently, the head of Freedom House, which is a CIA-interlocked NGO which promotes property rights abroad and is in the thick of covert, not-so-covert efforts to undermine governments that trample on property rights, especially the property rights of foreign investors and corporations. He is an exceedingly wealthy man. He made a fortune working alongside junk bond king Michael Milken. And after graduating from college, he did a PhD at Tufts University Fletcher School, where he worked with a man named Gene Sharp. And Gene Sharp is credited with being the first person to apply techniques of civil disobedience within a military context. So to develop civil disobedience as a form of nonviolent warfare. So Ackerman spent 8 years at Tufts refining Sharp's thesis, and after he got his PhD, he joined the investment bank Drexel Burnham Lampert, and he worked for Milken there. In 1988, he made $165 million after putting together the $26 billion KKR leveraged buyout of RJR Nabisco. A year later, he was worth $500 million. He quit finance and he turned to whittling down his immense PhD dissertation into a book, which he called Strategic Nonviolent Conflict, which essentially takes the civil disobedience techniques that Gene Sharp had articulated and tries to promote them. But it's kind of interesting to ask, or it's important to understand exactly what it is. I mean, we talk about nonviolence or nonviolent resistance. And nonviolence, I think, has a certain cachet or reputation or credibility. But what exactly is meant by nonviolence when Peter Ackerman talks about it? He defines it as the shrewd use of strikes, boycotts, civil disobedience, mass protests, and sabotage, nonviolent sabotage, to disrupt the functioning of a government to make a country ungovernable in order to seize power. And he's very clear that he's not talking about pacifism as a moral or ethical position, and he's not talking about speaking truth to power, and he's not talking about pressuring elites. As he puts it, nonviolent resistance isn't about making a point, it's about taking power. But where Peter Ackerman is involved, or in the countries in which he's involved, which would be places like Cuba, Iran, Venezuela, the intention is to overthrow governments that, in many cases, are encroaching upon property rights in order to install, say, neoliberal regimes that are favorable to Washington.
It's interesting. If I recall correctly, Sharp favored that social science concept of authority, you know, and especially attacking a government by removing its sources of authority or its legitimacy. So how do you go about doing that exactly?
Well, right. I mean, exactly. So Sharp's analysis says that a government exacts obedience in two ways. It can coerce people into obedience because the state controls the police and the military and prisons, etc. Or, he argues, in most cases, people aren't coerced into obeying. People obey because they want to, because they've been persuaded that their government is legitimate and has a legitimate right to rule. So the essence of his technique is to undermine that perceived legitimacy. And one of the ways of doing that is to describe a government that you want to overthrow as being dictatorial or authoritarian, and the forces that are opposed to it as being democratic. So you'll see that there has, for a while, been an attempt to brand, say, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela as, if not dictatorial, then authoritarian. And this kind of technique is used in all of the countries in which Ackerman and Sharp and other proponents of nonviolent resistance have been active, and that's a technique of simply branding governments or presidents or prime ministers, heads of governments who have been elected as dictators. And when it's said, well, how could they be dictators? They are elected in legitimate elections. Well, then the claim is made that the elections weren't legitimate and the elections were stolen.
Well, I mean, there's been some great examples. You mentioned Hugo Chavez in Venezuela. There's been Iran as well, right? Because now President Ahmadinejad is a dictator because the election he ran in was not legitimate, according to, well, what evidence? I'm not sure. They didn't really present strong evidence that he did not win that election.
Yeah, exactly. No evidence at all. But I suppose you might be able to adduce some evidence, but it's not very compelling. The only really sound or methodologically sound opinion poll that had been done prior to the election had been sponsored by kind of the international arm of the Republican Party, so the International Republican Institute, which certainly doesn't favor Ahmadinejad. And that poll suggested that Ahmadinejad would win handily, and in fact by a greater margin than he actually did win. So when you look at the evidence on balance seems to suggest that the election was legitimate. However, the claim has been made that it's illegitimate, and this follows exactly Sharp's techniques. I mean, what you have to do is undermine Ahmadinejad's legitimacy by saying that he's not ruling legitimately because he came to power through fraudulent means.
So if you, whether it's Chavez in Venezuela or Ahmadinejad in Iran or even Mugabe in Zimbabwe, what the technique then is to ignore what those presidents are saying or perhaps even doing in regard to the program that they say they're doing, whether it's, you know, to boost up the economy of the country, social redistribution of spending, welfare programs, whether it's, you know, fighting foreign powers and fighting oppression. You ignore that and you just say they're dictators or they're thieves, or, you know, like what they do with Castro. He's power hungry. He owns the whole country, that sort of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And part of the program as well is to breed cynicism about the leaders that you want to overthrow. And I mentioned that because you said Castro. I mean, the idea here is, or the idea that they try and propagate is that certainly Castro couldn't be motivated by any kind of ideology or commitment to socialism or to the independence of Cuba. He must be corrupt and is simply power hungry. And he's trying to hold on to power by any means possible, simply because he wants power.
So they paint a skewed analysis, and of course, and it's been mentioned on the program before, anyone who's opposing these people, no matter who they are or whatever, they're democratic, as you said. So it's the angelization of the opposition, the demonization of the existing government. The other thing, though, I mean, do you think that this sort of fits more broadly into the way that Freedom House. I mean, you mentioned Freedom House. The way that it ranks countries, you know, so that some are more democratic than others, and invariably, you know, the more of a U.S. friendly client regime you are, the higher you are on the list of democratic countries in Freedom House, and the lower you are, the more you seem to oppose that economic system.
Yes, and if you take a look at the countries that are lowest on the rankings, you'll find that all of them have encroached upon property rights in some fashion, or they place restrictions on foreign investment, or they place restrictions on foreign exports or imports into their country. So they're often places that people in boardrooms throughout the United States or on Wall Street are not particularly pleased with, because they're not providing them with the kind of profit-making opportunities they're looking for. So what you want to do is you want to replace the governments in those countries with governments that are more amenable to, you know, U.S. foreign investment, to U.S. trade. And the way to do that first is to undermine their legitimacy so that people no longer want to obey them or be governed by them and are willing to, you know, engage in the kind of civil disobedience that is now called color revolutions or people's revolutions.
Indeed, and it's always funny when you see CNN endorsing a revolution. But I think this brings us back to the idea of the nonviolent regime change, because, I mean, okay, so they say nonviolence, and you have people like Ackerman and Sharp promoting this and being involved in organizations that support it. But would you say that this nonviolent aspect, is it about strategic or tactical concerns, or is it about moral issues? Is it supported because of a sort of Gandhian ethic?
No, it's not about moral issues at all. And people like Ackerman and Sharp are very clear on that. They say we're not pacifists. This isn't a moral or ethical position. Our objective is to seize power, and we believe that this is the best way to do that from within. And the reason we believe that is because the state has a monopoly, or a legitimate monopoly, over the use of violence and force, and it's unlikely that people are going to be able to overthrow a government through armed struggle. That's their argument. They're more likely to be able to overthrow the government through civil disobedience and through measures to undermine the legitimacy of the government.
This is where it can get confusing, because, I mean, there's a lot of people here that are progressives, or they say they're on the left, and certainly there's a lot of support for the idea of strikes, boycotts, civil disobedience, you know, nonviolent sabotage, all these things we've mentioned. But then the question is, where does Ackerman and Sharp and those others fit into it? Because, like you pointed out, Ackerman said it's not true that the only way to take out the axis of evil regimes is through U.S. military action. There's other ways of doing it as well. So, do you think that he's in favor of the same sort of basic goals that Washington has when it approaches the countries like Iran and Syria and so on?
Absolutely. I mean, Peter Ackerman is a member of the U.S. ruling class. I mean, he sits on the premier U.S. ruling class foundation. I mean, the foundation, or the Center for Foreign Relations. He's a well-connected, exceedingly wealthy investor. Another principal in the nonviolence resistance movement is a man named Robert Helvey, who's a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Army. And how he became interested in nonviolent resistance was as a form of warfare, as an alternative. His interest, he was the U.S. Military attaché in Myanmar. And what he'd seen were rebel groups within Myanmar trying to overthrow the government and failing through armed struggle. He met Gene Sharp, and Gene Sharp, who's known as the Clausewitz of nonviolence, after the Prussian, you know, military strategist Karl von Clausewitz, Helvey met Sharp and discovered what he believed was a better way of challenging the government in Myanmar. So all these people are connected to the U.S. state. Where they're deployed is in countries that are kind of official enemies of Washington: Venezuela, Cuba, Belarus, Zimbabwe, Iran. And they're involved where the U.S. state has spending large amounts of money in efforts at effecting regime change. For example, in Iran, it's a matter of public record that the United States is spending hundreds of millions of dollars promoting rebel groups and civil disobedience. And Ackerman and Sharp and Helvey are all involved, openly involved, in training people in civil disobedience in order to destabilize the Iranian government, to bring it down so that someone can seize power. Now, it's interesting to look at all of the cases where color revolutions have succeeded in the past and then to ask, well, what happened afterward? And people who promote nonviolent resistance don't want to talk about that. And they don't want to talk about it because the consequences for working people in those countries have always been very grim. For example, in Yugoslavia, Ackerman celebrates the overthrow of Slobodan Milosevic in the year 2000 in Yugoslavia. And this was done largely through funding and training and outside assistance provided by the West to nonviolent activists who are trained by people like Helvey and Sharp. And what happened was after Milosevic was overthrown, there was a neoliberal regime installed, and the publicly and socially owned assets of Yugoslavia, most of which are sold off to Western investors and Western corporations. Unemployment soared. So things haven't been very good in these countries which have had color revolutions. The same is true in Georgia as well, where a color revolution was responsible for installing the current president, which many people in Georgia would like to get rid of. But it's curious that despite the irritation in the opposition to the current president, that a color revolution hasn't arisen, or kind of a color counter-revolution hasn't arisen there. And one of the reasons it hasn't arisen there is because the assistance and the money that Western governments and corporations or corporate foundations and wealthy individuals have provided to the Rose Revolution in Georgia, that funding has dried up. And it's dried up because they've installed the person they want in that country.
Yes, Saakashvili, and that was that's a very fascinating case because that's one of those cases where you can look and see what happened afterwards, and what happened afterwards is you have a major NATO or would want to be NATO ally who got himself embroiled in that conflict over South Ossetia. It was working very closely with members of the U.S. government, including John McCain's staff. So it's always very interesting to look into what happened in Georgia afterwards. So certainly, I think you're right on in there that there is a sort of pattern. And when you look at Venezuela, the people that are being supported by NGOs and part of nonviolent resistance. If it is nonviolent, on those times when it is nonviolent, it's not even a secret. It's the oligarchs, it's the upper class members of society, people that are not necessarily even supporters of democracy, as we saw when that coup occurred. And in Iran, the person that we were supporting, Mousavi, was an economic liberalizer, he wanted to bring those sort of ultra-market reforms, the Reagan-Thatcher-style government, changing from what Iran had previously. So I think there is that sort of pattern. What I found interesting that you mentioned a few minutes ago is people like Helvey, I believe it was, have experience in the army, and they see that this nonviolent activism is a method of achieving almost the same sort of goals. So is this like a toolkit thing where if you're the U.S. Or Great Britain or something, you want to change a government, you could invade, you could use military force, or you could apply sanctions, or you have other options like nonviolent resistance where you can hope you can mobilize people and help people destabilize or attack the legitimacy of a government. Is it like a bag where you have different tools and things to pick from?
Yes, absolutely. And nonviolent resistance, or what I call destabilization, because that's what it is. And destabilization has been done before. It was done in Chile, which led to the other September 11th. And it's curious that no one has kind of celebrated that destabilization as a people power or color revolution movement, although the activities of people in that destabilization are exactly the same as the kinds of activities that are undertaken today, you know, in places like Iran. But often, yes, it is part of the toolkit, and it's often used in conjunction with traditional means of violent warfare. For example, in Yugoslavia, the former Yugoslavia, while people like Ackerman attribute the demise of Slobodan Milosevic to you know, a bunch of anarchist activists who had received training and funding from the United States, it's also true. You can't ignore the context. In the context of a 78-day air war with massive violence, the use of sanctions, the kind of the creation of a political fifth column, all of these things, you know, these traditional ways of overthrowing governments have been used as well, including violence. So I think it's somewhat dishonest to say that the overthrow of the government in Yugoslavia, for example, or of Slobodan Milosevic, can be attributed entirely to a nonviolent resistance program or to civil disobedience. I mean, there was massive violence that played a role as well.
So it's good to take a more holistic view then. So when you look at destabilization, whether, you know, it could even be Iraq, but from Serbia and Yugoslavia to Venezuela or elsewhere, you're not dealing with things on their own. You're not just dealing with nonviolent resistance movements supported from outside. You're not just dealing with sanctions. You're not just dealing with, you know, international treaties, attempts to ban certain sales of goods and so on. These things are, they go together, and Ackerman and Sharp are part of a concerted initiative.
Yes, exactly. There's simply one element of a program that the United States and other Western governments engage in to affect regime change.
Well, it's just, I mean, it's interesting to me for a number of reasons. I am involved in activism, and, you know, we saw during the Iranian election there are discussions about what it really takes to organize something, organize large-scale protests. And, you know, I see real grass movements here in Hamilton and in Canada frequently. So we always get suspicious when a TV commentator is telling us about an anti-government grassroots movement in Iran or Venezuela or wherever, because of all the freaking money flowing in from everywhere. In Iran, small example is just all the signs that were printed in English all over the place that were, you know, intended for foreign consumption, it seems. And it was more extensive in Serbia and Ukraine when you had the rock concerts, remember, and the laser light shows and the tent cities and so on. So how do the nonviolent change advocates rationalize this? Because, you know, on the one hand, you've got them saying it's about internal, local, grassroots organizations, you know, against some evil dictatorship. And they're always talking about, on the other hand, the support from the international community, from all the NGOs willing to help, from ways that you as a person or as a donor or whatever can get involved. So which is it? Can this work both ways?
Yeah. And you're right. The nonviolent resistance promoters are very careful to say that these kinds of movements don't arise as a result of outside assistance. But I think they've learned their lesson. They once said otherwise. Peter Ackerman, for example, in some of his earlier writings, boasted about how the United States assisted the activists in Yugoslavia to overthrow Milosevic. In earlier writings, he talked about, he told people to watch the streets in Iran. I mean, this is years ago. Essentially saying, this is what we're going to do in Iran, so watch the streets and you're going to see an uprising. And in that, he called on people to provide assistance to Iranian dissidents and on governments to do that. And yet, today, he'll argue that all of that assistance made no difference. Or he'll argue that there was no assistance, which is pretty difficult to do when, you know, you can read in the Washington Post that the United States government was spending $400 million on programs to destabilize Iran. Others, go to extremes and make absurd statements like, well, maybe they got $400 million, but it didn't make any difference. It's all spontaneous, which would then suggest that we have lots of governments and corporate foundations and wealthy individuals who are silly and are squandering their money. But that money is very helpful and very useful. And Robert Helvey, one of the promoters of nonviolent resistance, would even disagree, because in some of his writings he points out the necessity of outside material assistance. You need it to, as he pointed out, you need this assistance to buy radios, to buy media coverage, even simply money to provide to activists. And I mean, many of these activists are being paid. You could consider them kind of mercenaries, nonviolent warfare activists who are receiving money from abroad.
So Ackerman has been very vocal then about how you could help Iran, and I think one argument I've heard though is that okay, sure, $400 million were officially and openly spent to destabilize Iran according to the U.S. government documents and testimony, but on the other hand, countries like Iran can spend so much more. I mean, because Iran has a state and it has police and so on and so forth, you know, it is able to counter that influence to a much higher degree than the external infusion of hundreds of millions of U.S. dollars. So there's that argument that's been made. And then there's also the argument, and this is from people like Thomas Carruthers. I was studying him last year, and he was saying, well, you know, people talk about foreign interference and the fact that countries like the United States, Canada, Britain, and so on are funding and training people and providing all sorts of material assistance and technology and so forth to movements in other people's countries. But there'd have to be people on the ground who want change in the first place. So doesn't that make it democratic? If you're using all that training and money and expertise to help make change, you could argue that you're helping democracy because you're helping those people that want change. So what do you think about that?
Well, two points I could make. Number one, I mean, in any country, there's always going to be a group or a sector of the population that's opposed to the government. If 20% is opposed to the government and 20% are trained and encouraged to rise up against the government, does that make it a popular or democratic movement? There's always this assumption that when these movements arise, that they represent the majority. How do we know they represent the majority? The second thing is, you could think about this from the perspective of Canada. I mean, if Canada had done something to irritate the U.S. government, and the U.S. government decided to punish Canada through the imposition of sanctions, and sanctions was disorganizing the economy of Canada, and people were suffering, losing their jobs, or we had a hyperinflation or whatever, you would see disillusionment and discontent with the Canadian government increase, and a number of people who might want the government to change its ways and to capitulate to the U.S. demands. That almost always happens in cases where nonviolent activists have been deployed. In Iran, we have sanctions. In Zimbabwe, you have sanctions. In Belarus, in many of these countries. So as I said, you always have to consider the context. The context is one in which these countries are being disorganized in other ways, in which a lot is being done to, you know, worsen the, or to diminish or undermine the lifestyles or the living standards of the people. And also then there's the information environment. I mean, all of these countries are not immune to Western media. They're all touched by Western media. And Western media has a certain view which can be used to persuade people to or to induce them to oppose their government or to control the way in which they understand the problems that they're experiencing. It's one of the things I've been thinking about recently. We in Canada, of course, guffawing at the way in which the U.S. media has been portraying Canadian healthcare, the Canadian healthcare system, and saying, you know, how could they get it so wrong? Well, it's obvious why they're getting it so wrong. It's politically inspired. Well, if the United States media can get Canada's health care system so wrong, and for political reasons. Perhaps we can get events in Iran wrong for political reasons or events in Venezuela.
Well, it's amazing to which degree they've been able to manipulate facts about a country that's on their northern border, in which many Canadians and Americans speak the same language and know each other and talk to each other regularly, and they're still able to create that level of distortion about our healthcare system. So if they can do that to Canada, you know, their neighbors to the north, that's amazing what they must be able to do to people across the ocean or in foreign countries who don't speak the same language as most Americans. I mean, certainly that's a very interesting point. Before we go, I know there's been some rebuttals to the arguments you've been making, and I think, for example, academics and researchers and others, people like Brian Martin, I believe was one person, said that the non-violence institutions that you're discussing also introduce or encourage and promote non-violent activism and resistance within protests and demonstrations that are occurring against U.S.-backed governments. So it's not just about changing the regimes of anti-United States countries. Do you agree with that?
Well, interestingly, he didn't say what countries they were. And so let's accept that it is happening. But this could be like saying, you know, the New York Times has a few token liberal columnists, therefore the U.S. or the New York Times is a balanced newspaper. That's what it seems to me to be saying. But we can look, though, at, if you look at nonviolent resistance in the way in which Ackerman defines it, which is a destabilization campaign intended to disrupt the government in order to seize power. Massive strikes, civil disobedience, sabotage. I see these things happening in Iran. I've seen them happen in Yugoslavia. I've seen them happen in Zimbabwe, but I haven't seen them happen in places like certainly haven't seen them happen in Canada or the United States or Britain.
You could look at Colombia or Saudi Arabia. Those tend to be described as U.S. client states.
Or Egypt.
Right.
Or Honduras.
Honduras.
Well, we do have some in Honduras.
Well, we did our own little actions in Honduras recently, which are not receiving a lot of publicity. But certainly there are countries that are part of the U.S. orbit that you could describe as anti-democratic or extremely corrupt or some such thing, and they don't seem to be receiving that kind of attention. I guess there's a difference between encouraging nonviolence in every movement that exists, but at the same time, funding and supporting and training certain of these movements to overthrow a government, whereas you're just promoting a certain idea in the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
The other point that I noticed that Brian Martin brought up was that he suggested that nonviolent resistance is a non-neutral tool. So what he meant by that is that it's inherently good, I suppose, or that it can't be used for domination. So by encouraging nonviolent resistance, you're encouraging types of activism that repudiate domination, and that's a good thing, and so it's a safe bet to promote that all around the world. Do you agree with that concept?
No, I don't. And I don't, Brian Martin has an anarchist perspective, so he's opposed to the state, and he's opposed to the state because it's a form of domination. So the question then becomes, is domination always bad? From the anarchist perspective, yes, it is. But you could argue from other perspectives that it's not necessarily bad. It depends who's being dominated and for what reason. He also argues, for example, that nuclear weapons are inherently bad. And this was in reply to an argument I made, which was that nonviolent resistance isn't necessarily bad or good. It depends upon why you're using it and what the consequences are. His argument is that it doesn't really depend on why you're using it, that it is intrinsically good. So the process can kind of be separated from the outcomes, which is an interesting idea that NVR promoters often advocate. And I think one of the reasons they advocate it is because if you start looking at the outcomes of some of the more celebrated deployments of nonviolent resistance then nonviolent resistance doesn't seem like such a good thing anymore. So the objective is, don't look at the outcome, simply look at the process. The process must be good because it's nonviolent and because it disrupts the state and can undermine domination. There's some anarchists who argue that nonviolent resistance, in fact, doesn't undermine the state and therefore is not good inherently because it does not disorganize or challenge domination.
Well, I guess in terms of outcomes then, there's a lot to look at. And it's turning into a bit of a theoretical debate, but if people want to look at, you know, what's actually happened in Serbia or Yugoslavia and what's been happening in Iran and so on, I guess I should direct people to your blog. It's called What's Left, right? What's Left. And I know you had a WordPress address. Did it move, or could you give us the URL for that?
Yes, it's gowans.wordpress.com.
Okay, so that's where you can find it, gowans.wordpress.com. So on that blog, there's a number of articles about these gentlemen we've been discussing, Peter Ackerman, Robert Helvey, Gene Sharp, and others, the activities of the institutions they're involved in, what this whole nonviolence debate has involved, as well as many other discussions of destabilization campaigns in countries like Iran in particular, and Venezuela, and so on. So I strongly encourage our listeners to go there. It's when you do the investigation of who's behind calls for, you know, regime change, who's asking for nonviolence, what is happening when, if they succeed in their objectives, and how do they go about doing that? When you start asking those questions, you can learn a lot more than is coming out just in the surface text. So, Stephen, I'd like to thank you very much for bringing this all to our listeners today. This was a wealth of detail. You've done some incisive analysis on this, and it's something that would be very difficult to get anywhere else. Once again, I'd like to thank you very much for coming on our program today.
Thank you for having me.